in journalism, storytelling, and nonprofit communications, and the key moments that led him to Minnesota. Please enjoy our conversation with David Knoyer from June of 2024.
I have always seen the world through stories. Stories are how we get to know each other. They're how we entertain and how we engage. They're how we impart culture and lessons. And yeah, we all have the Google at our fingertips, but you gotta kind of go talk to people and smell, taste, try it out. I think stories really are the kickstarter to that process.
Bonjour, hello. Welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem.
And I'm your other host, Cole Primo. Miigwech for joining us. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have captivating conversations with great guests from a whole lot of different backgrounds. We're talking musicians, artists, community leaders, doctors, educators, language warriors, you name it. They have a wonderful mix of passions, and we talk to them about those and their gifts and how they share their gifts with the community and, finding the big point of purpose in our lives and at the same time amplifying Native voices, of course. So, Leah, how are you doing today?
Doing well.
Yeah?
Enjoying life, enjoying the sun and the rain and the everything in between. How about you?
Doing great. Recovering from a cold, but we're alive. We're ready to go. We're excited for the show.
Nice. Well, I gotta say, we got our garden in.
Yeah.
We also planted a pollinator garden this year at the house. So I'm really excited about that. And we also put our old Halloween decorations to use. I have a zombie arm coming out of one of the planters.
Does that dissuade rabbits and such?
But it amuses me.
That's
so
awesome. I have a nice ant garden in the back, and it's not intentional, but I have to figure out a way to get rid of them. We'll see.
There you go. Your ant landlords.
Yeah.
Well, we also have a pair of woodchucks that are slowly destroying our yard, so we'll have to maneuver them elsewhere.
Yeah, I think we have like voles or something.
Ooh.
Every now and then you'll see like these little holes that are in the grass and sometimes where the ants are. And they probably get some good meals out of those ants, but we'll see. Mm-hmm. Home ownership.
Yep. One animal that likes to dig up our yard and do the little holes is a skunk.
Oh, yes. Yes. I did see that. When I was looking it up. Looking up the types of holes you can get in your yard, and I did see skunk, but I don't know if we have skunk in this area, but you never know.
Could be eating those grubs.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, more on that later. But I am really excited to share this conversation with you, Cole.
Yeah.
Our schedules are on and off with each other lately, but we still keep the program going. Sharing Native voices. So I'm going to share with you.
So much go on.
A guest.
Sorry.
Our latest and greatest guest, David Knoyer. David Knoyer is a citizen of the Rosebud Sioux tribe. He lives in the Twin Cities and he works in communications at ACES, the American Indian Science and Engineering Society. And he's been in storytelling for 3 decades, he's worked in nonprofit communications and journalism. And in David's bio, he says he believes stories can be the best way to connect people to each other and to new ideas. So it's a pretty great thinker, which you'll hear in our conversation. So,
all right, can't wait. Let's go.
Okay. Bonjour, David Knoyer. Thanks for joining me on Native Lights. Can you please take a moment and introduce yourself?
Well, hi, Leah. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I am a Knoyer in an Indian country. That means if you've been to South Dakota, you've probably heard of a Knoyer or two. My grandfather had a bunch of brothers, and so we're spread out all over the place. I'm enrolled at Rosebud. Both my parents are from there. They were high school sweethearts, and my father was in the Indian Health Service, and we moved around a lot, and I ended up in Florida, and I am a father I've got two daughters, young women. The youngest just graduated from college, so that felt really, really good. And I'm a recovering TV reporter. I'm a recovering foundation staff member, philanthropy, private philanthropy. I work for ACES, which promotes indigenous STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math education and careers in Minnesota. This will be 16 winters in a row, but last year didn't count, so maybe we should just say 15. And yeah, thank you. It's been great to know you. I've worked with your family, and my daughter is babysat for your child. So, hey, that's awesome when we have those personal relationships, right?
That's right. Yeah. Those babysitters are so valuable, especially when I know Marvin was very little when he was babysat. So, oh, such a relief. How are you doing lately, and how is your family?
I was doing some yard work 3 weeks ago and was trying to dig out this weed that turns into this stalk. And the top of the stalk was, you know, whipping around with me trying to pull it up, and it whipped right in my eye. And I'd never had anything like that happen. I didn't have my glasses on, and my eye was just this red blob. It looked terrible. And thankfully, the vision and the cornea wasn't hurt. It was okay. But geez, you know, quite a scare.
Yeah, I hear you. And well, and it's the season for yard work. Eye protection is very important. I like to kick off our conversations by asking if there's anything you're thinking about today that's like on the top of your mind. Like, for example, my kid has been bugging me today about Dungeons and Dragons. So anyway, is there anything that's on your mind lately?
You know, I'm in between trips, and the blessing of looking for stories and working for ACES actually is getting to go and look for stories of indigenous science, people exploring and failing. You know, the faster you fail, the sooner you succeed, the whole scientific method. So telling these stories I love doing it. I've been a big fan of this program, and it's a mid-level dental provider called the Dental Therapists. Why they call it therapist, I don't know, because one of them joked that, well, people think that, you know, they're providing some sort of mental health counseling to people who had bad experiences at the dentist's office. And that's kind of what they do. These are community people who have a certain level of training that isn't 6 years at dental school. It's like 3 years condensed into two. They're community people, and they can be nurse practitioner types for dentistry. So if you have a toothache, they can deal with it. They can deliver Novocaine. They can drill if they need to. They can fill. But basically, they're local people who want to work in the local dental clinic. They're not parachuting in to pay off, you know, college student loans and that kind of thing. And we know there aren't a lot of Native people providers, dentists and hygienists in the clinic to begin with. There aren't a lot. So this is a really cool model. And just hanging out with these folks, you know, was a lot of fun. You know, they're all revolutionaries, and it's a great story. So Google Dental Therapists and check out what the Swinomish tribe in Washington State is up to.
Wow, that's incredible. And so that brings us right into what your role is currently in communications for ACES, the American Indian Science and Engineering Society.
So I'm really trying to help ACES tell its story, but also the story of many, many people in the extended orbit of ACES who have their own stories, and they kind of relate to the same topic, but they're really, you know, those dental therapists, it's their story. You know, the people that have moved to Washington State from Michigan or other places, or Arizona, leaving their kids home because they couldn't afford to bring their kids to Washington State. So we know you make sacrifices for your education often, but to leave your, you know, your little ones home for that kind of extended time is crazy when you're a mom in particular, right? So trying to tell these stories and trying to help ACES focus on the stories and bring more people into the circle. Let's be excited about cultural fire. Let's be excited about putting these state-of-the-art sensors on a lake that produces wild rice so that we can see the temperature and the water depth and the wind and even the wake and the waves, right, from boats on that lake, because we know that climate change is impacting wild rice. So those types of stories are what I think get people to the fire, you know, bring people together. And then we have to work on making those connections.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with David Knoyer, Rosebud Sioux tribal member and communications expert. Okay, I have this pitch, and I am not going to claim it. It came to me at some point, and I don't think I'll ever have time to do it, so anybody's free to take it over. But I would love to create a television series or a movie or a play, some sort of script where all the characters or the whole premise is society has decided to listen to Indigenous people. And what that future looks like if we listen to Indigenous values and wisdom and technologies. So just putting that out there.
I think that's one of the challenges is we know that this Indigenous knowledge, call it what you will, way of living, the good life that Ojibwe people talked about, right? All of the relationships between people and planet and nature, sustainability, we knew what it was, right? I saw this great quote of when the settlers arrived, they thought that the forests were doing their own thing with no stewardship or no management. These native people weren't doing anything to the land, right? So all that is bunk. Native people have been managing forests for generations in their own way. When you look at Google Maps and you look down at the Menominee Indian Reservation in Wisconsin, you can literally see this square reservation that pops out that's these verdant green forests. They've been cut down, but they've sustained them in their own way. And you can literally see the outlines of the reservation from outer space because of, right, the stewardship of the Menominee tribe. And talking to a soil scientist a couple weeks ago, she said the Zuni Pueblo have 16, 17, 18 different names for soil. The Pueblo, right? They have no water. That's crazy, right? But, you know, they're able to farm the land and make things grow there like the Hopi people, with hardly next to no water, and somehow they can get corn to come out of the rock dirt.
That's incredible. Yeah, totally. And so you started out in journalism. Can you tell me a little bit about how you became a journalist?
Like a lot of kids, sports was a big thing for me. My father was an Indian Health Service administrator, and he was loaned out in the 70s to go help start United Southeastern Tribes, which didn't exist. That's the Intertribal Alliance from Florida to Maine and over to New York. So Seminoles, Mississippi Choctaws, Eastern Band of Cherokee, Six Nations, the Maine tribes as well, state of Maine. And so we moved to Florida, 1,800 miles from Rapid City, South Dakota. Baseball was a year-round thing there. So I just became a huge baseball fan and played constantly and wanted to be a sportscaster. In my high school, I was the PA announcer for the football games, some basketball, and I really wanted to be Bob Costas, you know. Sports ended up being kind of too routine and too kind of repetitive, and I'm like, I'll just do news, and that was better. So I had an internship with CBS News, which back then still, you know, was the big dog because there was no internet, there was no Facebook. Everybody was watching, you know, Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather. And so my first news job was in Albuquerque, New Mexico, making $7.26 an hour.
So you could get your fast food lunch and buy movie tickets.
I remember my parents were still paying my car insurance, you know, for sure.
Oh, my goodness. What did you like about reporting the news?
I like telling stories, and I like kind of really being in the know and being at the scene right before everybody else. I really enjoyed that. And I enjoyed the challenge of seeing something and then having to interpret it for other people, you know, in a very kind of real-time way. But I really loved the challenge of turning that around on a daily basis and having only so many hours to tell a really good story with what you got, the best building blocks that you have. the teamwork and that, and the writing, right? The writing was really important. And then the people skills to try to get people to talk to you and tell them, you know, what they saw or help tell the story. Because I've always been somebody driven by quotes and people. I need the quote and I need the person's perspective in order to build the story around it. And then sometimes, you know, you just got to talk to 10 people and then you only get two quotes that are any good, right? But you still got to, you know, do it. So,
well, I like news and storytelling and journalism. I always loved school, just loved learning. I knew in college, I was like, if I could choose a career, it would be to be a professional college student my entire life. And what I find is storytelling, journalism, I feel like I get to go to school every day and learn something new and learn something so much that I can analyze, interpret, and synthesize it to help share it to an audience.
Yes.
And so I feel like I'm kind of a student learner, a little bit of a teacher with the assistance of the people being interviewed, all in one piece. So I find it really scratches that learning itch.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more. So when I interned at CBS and I got to hang around some really, really, you know, veteran people, one of the things they talked about was you only might have a minute and a half to tell your story. And a minute and a half is 90 seconds. So what, 22 lines of copy for your minute and a half. But they said in order to distill something that concise, you need to know even more about the issue. And that's hard. It takes people and it takes some time and takes some analysis and it takes some experience to actually know what you're talking about. And, you know, you don't have to be an expert, right? But you kind of need to know how to find the expert and how to ask the right questions of the expert. I didn't know anything at 25. I didn't know anything at 29 or 35, right? It really takes some folks who've been at it 20, 30 years. You know, when you think you're looking at the top of the iceberg, you need to be able to talk about more of what's under the surface that you can't see.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about career. I know you mentioned the scientific method when talking about ACES, and I wrote down fail to succeed. So how failure is an important part of eventual success. I've had to change my perspective on failure as a recovering perfectionist, that failure is evidence that I'm at least trying something. So if I fail something, I'm like, well, at least that means I tried something. You know, better luck next time.
Exactly.
Do you have some moments maybe that maybe pop out to you when you think of failing to succeed in your own career trajectory?
So one of the problems in journalism, right, is people are afraid to make mistakes. And so rather than being more transparent and asking people to help them get it right, they don't want to ask anybody. And so there's this sort of entitlement. And I guess, you know, just as a male in particular, I think I had a lot of that growing up where, you know, I was raised in a particular religious way. I was first born, straight and narrow type stuff, black and white, you know, looking at the world right and wrong, and didn't have a lot of grays and wasn't really taught about a lot of both ands. You know, it was more either or in my upbringing. I think that's a big deal with some people. It was certainly with me, and it took me a long time before I started to have more appreciation for that. And part of it is, you know, I think I know what I want. I think I know what I want to do, and not asking enough people for advice and really listening and then being skeptical about some of the advice you get. I'm pretty happy with where I'm at, but of course you have questions, you know. At one point I wanted to be a network news correspondent reporter. I gave that a shot and CBS didn't know what to do with me because I wasn't dying to have my face on TV. I was happy just to be, you know, a producer behind the scenes. And so, you know, they ended up offering me a job at their Detroit station, you know, when I was about 30 years old. And Detroit just didn't sound like it was the right thing for me at the time, but that's what CBS News offered me. And you know, if I really wanted to work at CBS, I couldn't say no. So I said no. I ended up working for Fox News when they first started their cable channel, before they had that real conservative bent. But that was a tough year because it was their first year on the air and we didn't have a lot of people. And I was in Colorado covering the Denver, Oklahoma City bombing trials, and JonBenet Ramsey, that little girl, was killed in her house. And those were huge stories that three or four of us were trying to cover. And that was just a long, miserable year. So, you know, then I went to nonprofits and went to go work for the American Indian College Fund, which really felt good. First time, you know, my media, my communications experience, and my personal tribal background really came together, and it really felt right. You know, there's a tribal college on the Rosebud Reservation where I'm from, actually named after my great-great-great-grandfather type thing. And so education, as we know, is really important. Well, the Kellogg Foundation had a big project with the tribal colleges, and I ended up finding these stories for the foundation about what their investments were doing at the tribal colleges, which were still pretty small at the time and didn't have a huge communications capacity to tell their own story. They're just trying to do the work, as we know, right? There's so many cool stories in Indian country, but there's nobody whose job it is often to stay on top of them. And the people who are making news in Indian country are too busy making news, and no one's telling these stories, right? And it's by accident. So anyhow, Kellogg had an opening one day, and I'd done a pretty good job of finding those stories. And yeah, I'll move to Battle Creek, Michigan. You know, Michigan's kind of a tough place. We've got tribes there, but a lot of them have only been federally recognized in the last 30 years, and they're pretty small. And then you've got the Sault Ste. Marie Band in the UP, and you know, so there's not a huge native presence in Michigan. You know, I had a lot of people say, oh, Dave, you could be a foundation president. You know, you'd be a great foundation executive, da, 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 da. Here I'm like, what are you talking about, right? I'm like 33, 34, 35. Wasn't even something that occurred to me that really, right? But I didn't. That wasn't, I'm not, you're not talking to a foundation president right now. So, you know, I think life has got weird twists and turns, and I think my only advice to people is ask as much advice as you can get and be open to all that advice.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with David Kanoyer, Rosebud Sioux tribal member and communications expert. Yeah, I always wondered how you went from journalism to philanthropy. And then how did you get to the Twin Cities?
So being in TV news back in the day, right, you move. And so I started in Albuquerque. I went to West Palm Beach. I came to Minneapolis in the 90s at Care 11 for two winters. Then to Denver, Fox News. So I was moving, and probably to this day, I would move every 3 years if it was left to my own devices. Well, then, you know, you get married and you have little Marvin and or little daughters as we had, and their mother was like, no, no more. And so we had to pick a place. I'd been in Minneapolis in the 90s and, you know, liked the Indian community. And I knew there was enough here that when I got bored, there would be other things to do. It's not a bad place to live. If you can get through winter, you know, if we had more winters like last year, right, this place would look like California.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. And then now, of course, back full circle in communications at ACES, telling these stories of Indigenous science, Indigenous brilliance. Is there something particular that motivates you to do the work you do now?
I think telling a great story is what I really enjoy, but it's not for me. It's you can tell, right, Leah? You can tell when you've done it right and you took extra time and went the extra mile to tell that story as authentically and as respectfully and in ways that honor, right, honor the people involved. It's not always perfect. It's never going to be perfect, but you did the best job you could. And you know, just because you're Leah, you know, you're already right so far ahead of the, you know, you got such a head start on people for lots of good reasons that it's a gift that you gave them, right? It's this awesome gift that it's probably the first time in their life that some people have had their story told in such a beautiful, real way. And I think that feeling, it just gives you a lot of satisfaction. Even if you don't get feedback and a bunch of likes on Facebook or whatever, right? You just know that you know, right? You know.
Yeah, I love that. And you mentioned advice. So if you did have something to say to a person who is seeking to be a storyteller or journalist, what would you advise?
Well, first, I would say, you know, listen to Leah Lim's stories. Listen to as many stories as you can. Really pick them apart. And what did you like about them? Why did this connect with you? And what are some different ways to tell stories? I think it's essential, but TV has a lot of complexity. So I would say start with audio, start with radio. And you don't have to worry about all your pictures, but the storytelling is the same. And we don't have enough storytellers anywhere, native, non-native, none. We just don't have enough, and we don't have a lot of people that can write. So I would say start on writing and start on audio and radio and just tell some different types of stories, right? Try to tell that minute and a half story. You know, how do you take this issue and put it in 22, 23, capitalized 12-point font lines and tell that story? You know, the whole scientific method and failing involves research and involves data and involves feedback and evaluation. And that can sound like super, I'm going to put my white lab coat on and become an evaluator. But how does this connect to you? Or, mom, let me tell you the story. What do you hear? Just asking them, what do they hear, right, is so important to what we're talking about, because so many people don't ever ask that. And they put up their flyer or they write their story or they put their post up and they really have never gotten any feedback about it. And they might get a bunch of likes because it's some popular issue, but it wasn't told very well.
All right. That was David Kanoyer, citizen of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, working in storytelling for quite a few years now. What'd you think, Cole?
His knowledge on science and astronomy and things like that. I'm glad, you know, to hear him, you know, taking that and sharing indigenous knowledge when it comes to science.
Yep.
And I'll also take his advice to heart when it comes to eye protection, getting out there on the yard, doing some weed whacking. I got to get those eyes covered up.
For sure.
So miigwech to our guest, David Kanoyer. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lim. Miigwech for listening. Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
You were just listening to Native Lights here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Now it's time for KAXE Rewind, where we look back at some conversations we had this previous week on KAXE. Later in the show, we're having a conversation with Lakeland PBS General Manager Jeff Hanks and a tune from a band called Water From Your Eyes. But first, KAXE and Stay Human present The Authentic Voice, live storytelling concert Saturday, September 20th at 7 p.m. at Clockow Brewing in Grand Rapids. The event features nationally known storyteller Lauren Neamy and some of Stay Human's regular contributors, made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Recently, legislators voted to rescind federal funding for public media, and that includes not only our station, KXE KBXE, but also other public media stations like Lakeland PBS. Here to talk more about what that means for public television is General Manager of Lakeland PBS, Jeff Hanks, who we talked to on the Wednesday morning show this past week. With the recent federal funding being rescinded, it affected not only radio stations like our own, but also public television. Here to talk more about it is Lakeland PBS General Manager Jeff Hanks. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Well, thank you, Andrew and Heidi. I greatly appreciate you having me on. It's just a wonderful opportunity to talk to folks.
Well, we're still here. That's good, right?
That's right. We're still here. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've been, and as long as you folks, you know, we've been letting folks know that we're here. We're here to stay. We're going to fight for our existence. And, you know, we're having to kind of pivot relatively quickly here with a new funding environment. But we have a lot of support and encouragement coming our way. And we know we provide a vital service, all of us. And right. We're going to do what we can to keep that going.
Yeah, so let's talk about it. Where does Lakeland PBS get their funding from?
Okay, great question. Well, you know, previously, we would get some operating grants through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB. And for us, as a small rural PBS station, that amounted to about 37% of our operating budget, okay? But besides that, we also received some state grants as well in the form of matching grants and some small equipment grants from the state of Minnesota as well. But beyond that, you know, we worked very hard, just like yourselves, to, seek support from private foundations, local business underwriting, been great supporters, and, of course, membership support. And of course, you know, we serve basically from the Canadian border down to Little Falls, you know, east over to Grand Rapids, west over to Wadena, you know, Boston. So it's a vast coverage area, but it's also very rural, as you know. Mm-hmm. So there's really, as opposed to a metro market, there's limited resources as far as numbers of, you know, individual members and, you know, major donors, businesses, that sort of thing. So our revenue comes from multiple sources, you know, both public and, some state funding. But with the loss of that federal funding now, we're just leaning more heavily on those other pieces.
Yeah. Oh. I was going to say, in this whole conversation that has been happening since before the rescission, but I mean, it's been good in some ways to be able to talk about why it matters and how we're funded and be transparent. I'm sure that's been one of your big things, is to make sure people know exactly what we're doing, how we're doing it. But I think what's been, I'm sure you have felt this too, what's been lost in the kind of national narrative about this is rural places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And as you're both well aware, you're familiar with how we operate at Lakeland PBS, and we do a lot of different things. You know, we do local arts, culture, history programming, but really our kind of our signature service is our Lakeland News. That we're now in our 27th year of providing. And of course, that's the only televised newscast in North Central Minnesota. So that's, you know, highly watched. It's trusted for 27 years now. And through that broadcast, you know, we're covering stories in these rural communities, you know, from Black Duck to Reamer to Walker to Bagley, you know, those small stories from small towns, organizations, everything from school board coverage to local city government to nonprofit organizations are having an event, you know, having some sort of a initiative. You know, we're covering those things that just wouldn't be covered by the bigger, Metro, Grand Forks, Duluth TV coverage, news coverage. So we've filled that gap, and really, you know, that's what that CPB funding was for years ago. That the Public Broadcasting Act was meant to provide universal service to cover those gaps where commercial media just wasn't gonna, you know, try and make a run of it. That's what. In effect, what it did here in North Central Minnesota, the Lakeland News, and made that possible. But now that being gone, you know, obviously we have a trusted product; it's very popular. But we need to lean into other forms of support to keep it going, since it's a very expensive endeavor for a small station.
And it wasn't like an endeavor that was just done on a whim. It was something that was asking the people of our area of, what do you want to see on your Lakeland PBS station? And one of them was local news coverage.
Yep.
And like you said, been doing that for 27 years. And,
he can't do it without the people's support, and that's what people wanted.
That's right. You know, we started, you know, Lakeland News back in 1998. It is kind of a funny story. It actually, a lot of it stemmed from some, you know, surveys we did at that time. That was back when the Grand Forks flooding, the Red River flooding was happening. There were so many of those folks were displaced here. And that was just one of the major news events that was happening. People were looking for information. And, you know, we did a lot of surveys. And like Andrew said, you know, we just heard overwhelmingly that what people want in our region was that local news coverage. That's what would be most important to them. So we, at that point, we kind of put all our eggs and all our resources in that new endeavor, Lakeland News, and jumped in and went from there. But again, we're providing that service that no other television broadcaster is doing. So again, that's what carries a lot of weight with people and our stakeholders.
Is it right that Lakeland is one of the only places that has a news coverage like this, rural public stations across the nation?
Yeah, definitely one of just a handful, I would say, especially, PBS stations. I think a lot more are leaning into local news coverage over the past several years to different degrees, different looks, but providing a live half-hour nightly newscast is still not done by a lot of PBS stations across. It's done by very few, and especially by small stations. Again, we just, when we're able to make that happen by just being extremely efficient. We're a small crew, as Andrew well knows, has experience working with us in the past. But we all wear a lot of hats. You know that story for a lot of nonprofits. We all wear a lot of hats, but just very efficient and, you know, making those dollars that we do get in support for Lakeland News and our other productions go a long way. So,
you know, I always get kind of up on a soapbox about this, but it's so important if you live in the places we live in that you see your life and your experience reflected. You know, if things like Lakeland go away or KEXC, national media does not, unless, let's say the storms, the derecho this summer in Bemidji, certainly national or statewide media came in, but they go away after that storm. And people still need to know, like, where are you going to bring the branches? Where are you going to do all this stuff? That's not something the Star Tribune is going to cover because if they do come and cover a story here, they're doing that for an urban audience.
They're looking at it through a different lens, really. They do great service,
right,
don't get me wrong, absolutely, but it's that the day in, day out grind of the work that you folks are doing and we're doing, that truly local public media. We're both telling stories from people and places that matter to our friends and neighbors in Grand Rapids, in Coleraine, you know, in Deer River, Bemidji. You know, we're covering those stories that just wouldn't be covered otherwise. A good example, personally, you know, the Black Duck high school softball team went to state for the first time ever this last spring. And our sports coverage is fantastic. Charlie Egger, our sports director, does a good job. He covered that story really well. And I was reached out to by some parents up in Black Duck area. It's just like, wow, that coverage just meant a lot to us and our community of that team and those kids and what it meant. That just wouldn't be happening otherwise. Stories like that. But that's just one example from one day, one week, you know, one spring of one year. But we're doing that day in and day out. So people are going to miss that if that goes away. So that's what we're fighting for.
And kind of going on what you were saying, Heidi, of like when other outlets come in to cover our area, it's usually something like a disaster happens or some bad news is happening that they'll come and cover that. But we are shining a light on like the positive things of our area as well. And we're not, like you said, Heidi, we're not going away. This is our home. This is, we want to promote the good things that are happening in our area, which like you do at Lakeland PBS.
Yeah, that's right. You know, like yourselves, our reporters live right here. We face the same issues and challenges and opportunities as everyone else out there. So operations like us, you know, both of our organizations, we're in tune with all of our communities, and we actively seek feedback from those communities, you know, unlike the larger metro media services. They're looking at it through a different lens. So we're here, and that's our mission.
We're talking with General Manager of Lakeland Public Television, Jeff Hanks. We're talking about the public funding that was rescinded from the federal government for all of public media. Okay, so here's kind of a personal question. How you approach, let's say, Lakeland News, a lot of what was happening in the national narrative was saying that public media has a political bias. What did that mean to you? What's it actually like, or how do you feel about the news that you do in terms of people thinking that?
Yeah. Thanks for that question. that was definitely a tough one for us. And I would push back against that. We're all about local coverage. That's what local stations are about. And, you know, people have presented that argument before, and I've said, point out some specific examples of, biased coverage in our news coverage, in our stories. You know, I'm a patient guy. I'll mm-hmm. wait. You know, mm-hmm. if you can give me some examples of that, we'll take that and learn, if there's some examples. But it's we really don't see that with our coverage. You know, people have pointed out the national PBS programming as being some examples. We don't specifically have control over that per se, but definitely with our local productions we strive for that balanced mm-hmm. coverage, and I think we've proven that over 25 years or 45 years actually of our mm-hmm. existence. But beyond that, we're also a 501c3 nonprofit. We're governed by a board of directors that's rotating individuals from our community. And if there was, if there was a bias there, that would show up, with that governance just, would not allow that to happen, mm-hmm. in my mind, that oversight of seeing a service that's meant to serve everyone in all viewpoints.
One of the cool things I've thought of Lakeland over the years is how it is training the next generation of people working in public media or in TV in general.
Yeah.
What has that meant to you guys, or what? That's got to be a lot to manage, first of all, but also just a good thing to do in the world.
Yeah, it is. That's really been a fun fun thing to see, our news department, Dennis Wyman, our news director, has been with us since the beginning. You guys both know him well. He has basically just been a linchpin of that service, obviously. He loves teaching and the business of journalism, the basics of journalism, to these new reporters. Typically over the years we'd have younger reporters who would come straight out of a journalism program in college, and typically would be their first jobs or one of their first jobs. And Dennis just such a good job of teaching them the basics and giving them opportunities they wouldn't get in a short period of time. They're sitting behind that anchor desk, or they're covering many different stories. They're operating as a one-man band. So they're getting that opportunity to advance really quickly. So it's a great farm system, if you will, if you're looking at a baseball analogy. But we've had a lot of reporters go on to much bigger markets. We've got a reporter that's on NBC Nightly News. Dave Schwartz went on to Care 11. A lot of people know his name. There's a lot of examples like that. It's just that quality journalism basics that our team, instills in those folks and provide good service.
And along with what Lakeland PBS does in the television department, there's also educational resources that Lakeland PBS provides too, like local schools and stuff like that. What are kind of the other things that Lakeland PBS does besides just television?
Yeah, thank you for that. We kind of get lost a lot of times in our main service. We do so much other things. I talked about our arts, culture, history programming. We have had a series focusing on local arts and music, Backroads, of course. A lot of documentaries about local history, local culture events. But along with that, we also produce lesson plans. that align to state standards for educators, that are free and available to, you know, local, you know, homeschoolers or, you know, local school districts, teachers to utilize. For instance, if we did a documentary on recently on the Boys of Bataan, from the Brainerd area, that in World War II, that story. So it was a really fascinating documentary of that story of those young men from the Brainerd area who went in World War II, went to Bataan, gave the ultimate sacrifice. So it was a well-done documentary, but we then took that and worked with a local educator, local teacher, to provide a lesson plan. Downloadable, free, utilizing that documentary that teachers, homeschoolers can use. And that's just one example. So we have all these free lesson plans that tie to our productions, and along with the national PBS productions as well. So education is a big component.
So how have viewers responded? How have your members responded since this happened?
It's been fantastic. I was just writing monthly highlights publication. I was writing my article yesterday, and I was thinking back on the past couple months, and it's definitely been challenging, and you know, some heartache and heartburn. But we've just seen an outpouring of support. We've definitely seen an uptick in you know, our membership donations, which is absolutely wonderful. Absolutely wonderful, and we've seen that across the system. But again, for a small rural station, that's going to be that's awfully hard to fill that gap that we're looking at, of course. But along with that, just all the messages of encouragement: hey, we have your back. You know, we support public media. We believe in what you're doing. From across the board, we've seen that: calls, letters, emails, you name it. We've had people contacting us. I just noticed a pledge come in this morning, as a matter of fact, from Portland, Oregon.
Oh, wow.
There is an effort out there called Adopt a Station, basically a website that lists all the stations system-wide, radio, TV, everything. And people can search on there, and it kind of shows what their need is, you know, with the rescission of the funding. And it takes to the websites of the stations, and it gives a direct opportunity to give. So people are out there actively wanting to support public media. So it's just been really heartening to see all the support we've gotten.
And I suppose, so it sounds like, so you'll do kind of to deal with this loss of funding, you kind of just have to scramble like we are, finding other sources and fulfilling our missions and doing what we're doing.
That's right, Heidi. First and foremost, you know, we have a great board of directors, and they recognize, along with our staff, you know, number one, we work really efficiently to provide a good quality local service that people utilize, find relevant, and want to buy into. You know, so that's number one, provide that service. But with that federal funding being gone, yes, it is a bit of a scramble. We are we're fortunate at Lakeland. We do have some reserves that we're able to draw on for the coming year to help support our various services. But those reserves are finite. They're not going to last forever. So obviously, we're pivoting. We are going to be launching a aggressive campaign in the coming months, coming year, attacking all those different angles. Again, you know, foundations, individual members, major donors, all those things. We're just going to be really reaching out and, you know, with our story and our plan, and you know, trying to backfill that gap as much as we can.
Yeah, and if you want to show support for what Lakeland PBS does, that website, lptv.org, with the big donate button.
That's right.
And we sure have appreciated over the years working with you, and kind of the relationship that most public media has with each other, mm-hmm. you know, this sharing sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Over the years, I mean, that's where I first learned how to talk to elected officials or people who are running for office, as you invited us in. I remember, like, early on, Scott Hall was going to do it, and I was like, okay, can I go with? I want to see what's going on here. Mm-hmm. Not thinking that, like, hey, I might be sitting on these panels later or figure that kind of thing out. Mm-hmm. Now, that may not seem like a big deal that, you know, you invite other media to be on these panels, but for us, that would be so hard to manage that whole thing. So just to be one little part of it, but be able to ask the questions that we need to ask, and be involved in it, is huge. We could not manage that on our own. So we've always really appreciated being asked and being a part of that kind of thing.
Thank you for bringing that up, Heidi. And you're referring to our debate night, our local House and Senate debates that we produce during election cycles. We've been doing those for a long time now, basically since late 90s as well, early 2000s, somewhere in there. We thought it would be a great way to show, unity with our, with our colleagues in media, mm-hmm. both nonprofit and profit, to help us out with that. It's a lot of leverage. With those debates, especially in recent years, some public people running for public office don't always, make themselves available for debates at different forums, but they've generally always showed up for our debates. It's a big deal, I think largely because we have partners like KXC on that panel, Bemidji Pioneer, Park Rapids Enterprise, Brainerd Dispatch. Those people are there really amplifying that coverage, and people get to hear directly what their elected officials, as far as Minnesota House and Senate, have to say, what their platform is through our debate night.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Jeff, for joining us this morning.
You're very welcome. I greatly appreciate the opportunity. It was great to see you two again.
Well, hang in there together, right?
Yes.
It sounds like we're all very determined. That's
good. Yes, we're all in this together.
Yep.
And that was our conversation with Jeff Hanks. You'll be able to find that conversation later on our website, kaxe.org. You're listening to KAXE Rewind, and now we're going to play a tune for you. This is a new one from the band Water From Your Eyes. This song is called Playing Classics.
Look, I'm concerned as a matter of fact. Contact, all the shattered and packed. Shake three. Desire and crisis, no longing for truth. Yeah, the long, hard road from here to truth. Shake six. Look, face contort, face the music that crashed. There's a war on stage, stop the glow into ash. Shake nine.
And that was the band Water From Your Eyes with their new tune, Playing Classics. You're listening to KAXE Rewind, where we take a look back at previous conversations we had this week on KAXE KBXE programming. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Begley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. That'll do it for KAXE Rewind for this week. Don't forget, you can check out a lot of our conversations we have on our website, KAXE.org.
KAXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And, oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KAXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.